and the role of Congress in foreign policy. He played an important role some years ago in an Atlantic Council project on the President, Congress, and foreign policy, but in many other areas he's also contributed. He comes as close to being a native of the home of our founder as you can come, I guess. He was born in Nashville, Tennessee, received his bachelor's degree from St. Louis. Yeah, there's a Tennessee connection here, Jack.
Good.
And his PhD from Yale. He was a strategic analyst at the RAND Corporation and then taught at UCLA and Harvard. He was staff director for Senator Ed Brooke and also has served as a consultant to a number of senators who have contributed in a major way. He's a charter fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center at the Smithsonian Institute, but for the last some 20 years he's worked in association with the Council on Foreign Relations and actually been a prime mover in the creation of the Washington branch of the Council. That branch now has some 700 members. The ORC founding branch has only 900, so in a very brief time Alton has played a leading role in bringing them into a position of great prominence. His books include a work entitled Nazi Germany and the American Hemisphere, 1933-1941, which deals with questions of Nazi penetration into the Western Hemisphere and various strategic issues, debates having to do with Franklin Roosevelt's policy and so on. And then the book A Responsible Congress, The Politics of National Security. It's strange that in the discussions we have had on arms control thus far, the whole subject of alliances, which is so central to the maintenance of a deterrent in this area and also to arms limitation, has not been emphasized particularly. So in speaking to the subject, alliances and arms control, Dr. Frye is addressing a problem of great interest to us all. The subtitle of his discussion is New Dimensions of Collective Security.
Thank you very much, Ken. I can't tell you how pleased I am to be in this wonderful setting. I've admired what's been going on at the center for a long time. I would have admired it even if I didn't know what was going on, simply because Ken Thompson is here. Though I never studied with Ken and have never done extended work with him, I have to say that I think of myself as a student who's benefited from his very important work. Even back long before he came to the University of Virginia, he has been a major force in the academic pursuit of insight into international politics, including its ethical dimensions, which bear such an important place in my own concerns. I have to say that things have reached a velocity of change so great that I found coming down my earlier ideas when I accepted the invitation have in some respects already been overtaken by events. Ideas that I thought might have seemed novel and fresh are already on the verge of being implemented. And so I feel a bit as though our prayers are being answered too fast for us to comprehend them all. It's a little bit like the woman in the bar of the Titanic at the moment of the collision who said, "I know I ordered ice, but this is ridiculous." I want, therefore, to say mostly some things about the role of alliances in this transforming process that is underway in East-West relations. But if we have time, perhaps, to add some views about a few bilateral issues in the strategic negotiations between the United States and the Soviet Union. So it'll be something of a more bifurcated commentary than I originally anticipated, and I'll ask your patience if I stray into some zones beyond the topic's domain. The best news I bring is that at long last, the caricature of an argument between the tough guys and the softies, between those who thought the only way to promote national security was a sound defense, and those who seemed to think that the only way was through negotiations and arms control, that argument is largely dissolving. Almost everyone in responsibility now understands that arms control is one instrument of national security. It is an instrument which partakes of the form of mutual security, which is in turn an application of the principle of collective security. It's not yet clear what the new security architecture is going to be in Europe or more widely in the world, but the principle is clear. We are constructing new models of security founded on the concept of collective security. That's a principle which was idealized in the United Nations Charter and in other regional and similar arrangements, but which we had not done a very good job of implementing. We now have a chance to move from a posture of deterrence built on mutual threat to a posture of deterrence and security based on mutual assurance that the weapons at the disposal of the great powers will not be used for hostile purposes. So we are in the early stages of what appears to be a probable conversion of the system from alliance confrontation and stalemate to alliances cooperating in a reductions regime with unprecedented verification arrangements. We already have seen hundreds of on-site inspections in Europe, the Soviet Union, and the United States. Many of those on-site inspections have been short-notice arrangements in which, within the matter of 48 hours or so, uninvited, unexpected inspectors have shown up on the scene to confirm that the activities taking place in the particular region are legitimate. Some of them have taken place under the Stockholm arrangements in the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. Many more have been taking place under the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And we are now working toward even more elaborate mutual assurances in the open skies proposals that President Bush revived, having been made originally in the Eisenhower administration. We're finding that there are, ironically, some problems with our own allies as we move into extensive inspection and verification arrangements. In the negotiations on conventional forces in Europe, our British and French and German friends have not been willing to go as far as we, the Americans, had thought wise, particularly in verifying production controls, examination of factory arrangements dealing with weapons. But I think there's good reason now to expect compromises that build a system maximizing the transparency of the military arrangements in both East and West, and confidence-building measures of various sorts are going to be the order of the day. Even with the evisceration of the Warsaw Pact, I want to argue that it is extremely important that we preserve and build upon the singular achievement of collective security, which is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I think it is an alliance which ought to have a future, even though there are some now calling for the abandonment of the alliance system on both sides. One of the things that I would have argued and thought that it was novel points in that direction, but has already been advanced by the discussions in Ottawa a few weeks ago. For the North Atlantic Treaty to play a role, particularly a role that engages the United States as a continuing force in the security arrangements in Europe, I think we have to have a bargain in which there is an asymmetry of treatment for American forces in Europe as opposed to Soviet forces in Europe. We're now about to get that asymmetry of treatment. The conventional force negotiations began with the objective of creating parity between the Warsaw Pact and NATO. In the discussions over the last few months, culminating in the Baker-Shevardnadze exchanges in Ottawa, the principle of asymmetry has now been substituted for the earlier goal of parity, asymmetry in favor of the United States. The two sides have agreed to seek a reduction in forces to 195,000 American and Soviet forces in the Central European area. But the Soviets have accepted the requirement by the United States to keep an additional 30,000 personnel in the nearby European theater, particularly in Great Britain and the Mediterranean area. I think that that's a very important aspect of the eventual bargain we must seek, for the simple reason that geography provides the Soviet Union with the interior line of communication, which we cannot manage across that big ocean. And for there to be balance and stability over the long haul, there has to be a sufficient extra capacity for the United States to maintain air and naval capabilities in the theater to permit us to move there rapidly were a crisis to develop. So I report rather than advocate, which I happen to do also, but I report that we are well on the way to getting a principle of asymmetry that gives one hope that the United States can remain a significant player in a new European security architecture centered on NATO. I immediately want to rush to a problem, however. The Soviets are leaving Eastern Europe very quickly. From Czechoslovakia and from Hungary, they will be out probably within a year after this summer. I make as an aside the point that in the discussions which some American officers had with their counterparts earlier this year, there was a repeated insistence by the Soviets that people had to understand they couldn't leave sooner than July. They couldn't take those people out of Hungary and Czechoslovakia before July. And when pressed, the Soviet officer said, "Don't you understand? Our kids don't get out of school until July." The reasons behind the timetable are not all strictly military. They are human, and I think we can understand them. But the problem I want to raise with you is if they leave as rapidly as now may happen, there will be political pressures in the United States, as well as in some parts of European politics, which may point toward a very drastic further reduction in American military deployments. If you take a long enough view, my personal comfort level would be that's all right, provided it does not go to zero. I would think that security and the investment we've made in European stability and global peace would argue for at least the air and naval infrastructure symbolized by this concession to asymmetry made at Ottawa by the Soviets. Now, that is mostly good news. I would like to move on to some more problematic issues for the balance of our discussion. I came across a wonderful and perplexing sign in a hotel in Oslo last year. In the bedroom, the sign in four languages said, in German, "Please do not smoke in bed." In French, it said, "Please do not smoke in bed." In what I took to be Norwegian, it said, "Please do not smoke in bed." And in English, it said, "Smoking in bed will kill you." Now, I take it from that interesting sign that we Anglo-Saxons have to hear the message in plain English. And I think it's easier to state the question in plain English today than it is to state definitive answers. The question in plain English for NATO and the United States is, can an alliance outlive its raison d'etre? That question has become acute as this transformation moves the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact into a totally different relationship with European security. The rapid shift in the military threat signals a success of unanticipated magnitude for NATO, but it also presents the most fundamental challenge we've ever faced. The cloud in this silver lining will not dissipate spontaneously. Thus, the search for a new mission for NATO is not only timely, it's absolutely imperative. That search has got to build on several candid assessments, and they don't all point in the same direction. First, the Allies need to keep in focus the reality that attitudes and perceptions are changing more quickly in the West than are the military capabilities in the East. Even with the drawdown that we see, the Soviet military force is a robust one with which we will have to cope in our planning for the indefinite future. Now, I want to make one point partly in response to an absent columnist who has argued that with the dissipation of power in Eastern Europe and the Soviet collapse, we should abandon all these complicated negotiations. Let's let them dissolve and just keep our own capabilities as we choose unilaterally. Rely on the process that is already unfolding to destroy the Soviet threat. I think his formulation was that all that's left to do in Vienna is go to the opera. Well, that's not all there is left to do in Vienna. That's a very clever line, but it's a horrid policy. Anyone who is prepared to base our security and our allies' security on spontaneous developments, I think, is not a responsible or serious voice. We have got a tremendous stake in making this a systematic, coordinated, verifiable process. And that's why the investment of diplomatic energy, which President Bush and the others are making, is wholly. We have to make the future course of all the parties in Europe transparent and predictable. Now, this emphasis on a negotiated approach strikes some cynics as just using diplomacy to postpone real change. After all, we did use the mutual and balanced force reduction talks, which went on for 14 years. We used it primarily to pacify domestic opinion, not to produce actual reductions. That's not the relevant precedent. We're in a situation now where the diplomacy can be fruitful, and we must avoid anything that suggests it is simply a delaying game to buy advantage. The protection against the suspicion that these negotiations are simply a way to postpone real change has to lie in progress at the bargaining table. We've got to show that NATO can produce a diplomatic tempo adequate to the occasion. There's a second caution that I think one would want to offer, and it's more general. History offers no ready examples of alliances which prospered after the threat that spawned them disappeared. Collective security is a difficult enterprise in the best of times. Indeed, from the standpoint of making alliances work, the worst of times is the best of times. Shared peril is the stuff of successful alliances, and finding a substitute to keep an alliance intact when the peril passes is a daunting task. From a different vantage point, that is the insight proffered by Georgi Arbatov when he speaks of denying the United States an enemy image. Soviet statecraft has gone far toward convincing Western citizens and governments that the worst of times is past. Indeed, I believe that to be true myself. But in surveying the transformation in Eastern Europe, we have to remember two truths deserve recognition. Western steadfastness made it possible. Mikhail Gorbachev made it happen. Gorbachev's extraordinary initiatives since 1985, above all his blend of tolerance and active promotion for reform in Eastern Europe, have been utterly subversive of the feeling of common danger that glued NATO together. We deceive ourselves to think otherwise, but we disserve our common interest to treat the threat to the alliance harmony as comparable in any degree to the risk of large-scale conflict which Allied solidarity has helped diminish. The bleak prognosis for an alliance without enemies overstates NATO's predicament. For even if one discounts the rhetoric of Allied summits and the tinge of gloating in NATO commentaries about its contribution to the changes taking place in the East, the fact remains that the Western alliance is a unique endeavor whose prospects cannot be judged automatically by historical precedents. Never have so many huddled together for so long, for so large a purpose. That habit of togetherness is a psychological and political asset in navigating the political shoals that lie ahead. To be sure, the possible demise of the alliance system is now contemplated anxiously or eagerly in various quarters. But there is widespread recognition in Europe as well as in most American national security circles that it would be premature to abandon NATO. For the near future, the challenges facing the alliance are not mortal, but managerial. What useful functions can it design and perform to the satisfaction of its members? And equally important, how can it adjust its internal balances and missions to match more appropriately the different environment in which it will now be operating? Again, we have to be careful. It behooves us to recognize that concocting new undertakings for NATO may veer toward make-work schemes that could sap both institutional morale and public support. The basic objective must be to hedge against disruption of the present auspicious trends and to return to a higher threat level. That insurance policy concept is sound, but it invites tough scrutiny of the costs NATO imposes on member states. Voters and therefore governments are bound to be tempted to scrimp on protection when they perceive the risk to be low. Probably the most promising emphasis, and the one I would want to highlight today, has been sketched by General John Galvin, the Supreme Allied Commander. It lies in an enhanced NATO role in the conventional force reduction process. The organization disposes of assets to monitor both force reductions and operational constraints, maneuver activity and the like. What could be more sensible than to apply the intelligence resources now devoted by NATO to gauging the threat to a cooperative verification regime intended to confirm that the threat is declining? NATO management of an open skies program would be a wise way both to track changes in the threat, obviously on a reciprocal basis, and to exercise capabilities which would be needed in the event current trends went sour. I make that point because there's a degree of short-sightedness creeping in which some of our member governments are insisting on exclusive national prerogatives for verification instead of cultivating a multilateral approach through NATO. The notion of engaging NATO actively in the security problems of other regions, an idea that Secretary Baker has put forward, poses more severe difficulties. Here, the habit of the institution works against the function. There's a powerful disinclination to take on burdens outside the NATO area, just as people are becoming comfortable with the resolution of major problems inside that area. The precedents are discouraging. Our European friends were not very helpful to us in regard to overflights during Middle East crises, during the reprisal against Libya for the act of terrorism against Americans in Berlin. It's not likely that we will see easier cooperation out of area when the imperatives of alliance seem weaker. For balance sake, I'd have to note that Britain and France would say that the same point arises from the American response to their action in Suez in 1956, when clearly we were not prepared to join them in an out-of-area venture they considered very important. The obstacles involve more than resistance to U.S. leadership. There are similar difficulties even among the Europeans for framing common policies toward regions such as the Middle East. But how one frames the question about out-of-area collaboration makes all the difference. NATO's usefulness in such episodes is less likely to be in eliciting direct multilateral action than in providing a forum and a context in which several allies may choose to act, even if all do not. The Persian Gulf convoy activity is perhaps the model we would like to have revived in other cases. The United States acted primarily on its own, but gradually, through a process of consultation within the alliance, there were collaborating Dutch operations with minesweepers in the Gulf. There were French and British operations of a supportive character. Acting individually rather than through the alliance, we nonetheless managed to get a reasonable approximation of a collective response to a security threat of the first magnitude during the Iran-Iraq war. The bottom line has to be, however, somewhat discouraging with regard to this particular topic. The out-of-area problems provide maximum probability of divergent interests and minimum incentives to submerge those differences for the sake of ongoing cooperation in other realms. Now, even as the pursuit of credible new functions proceeds, NATO is certain to experience changes at its core and in its central premises. Such changes already loom in the alliance doctrines of flexible response and forward defense, the two principal ingredients in NATO strategy. The bickering over modernization of short-range nuclear weapons has been resolved. Suggestions of new deployments of such forces in Germany are now met with derision. Hardly a year ago, we were all preoccupied in Washington with the need to make sure the Germans prove their reliability by accepting a follow-on to Lance, another short-range nuclear force. It would be totally counterproductive to press that kind of issue at a moment when the Germans have shifted their focus to betting not only on unification, but on political amelioration as the basis for their own security. This doesn't mean the end of the nuclear component of flexible response. It may well point toward the end of nuclear artillery as a residual force in the theater. What it does signal is the need to tailor the nuclear capabilities to a somewhat different range, an air-launched and a sea-launched capability, rather than something based on the continent, in order to serve deterrence and escalation control, in the jargon of the business. The second key component of NATO strategy that obviously is about to change concerns the Federal Republic's insistence over the entire history of the alliance on forward defense. If there's not going to be an inner German border defining the zone of confrontation, then it is certain that there will be no German desire to maintain heavy armor concentrations forward on German territory as the basis for forward defense. We're going to have to redefine it and recognize that a flexible force, ideally with a balance on the continent, will have to provide forward defense without forward deployment. Thinner and lighter forces are now likely to be the order of the day, and we've got to provide movement in that direction. Accompanying the remarkable developments in NATO's strategic opportunities and requirements is a noticeable change in NATO's internal equilibrium. The other allies no longer take their cues so readily from Washington. As former Norwegian Defense Minister Johan Holst puts it, the dual impulses of American unilateralism and European parochialism continue to produce signs of warning on the road ahead. We have a very difficult task in reconciling the many contending threads that are now being woven into the relationships. But I think the opportunity for doing so is facilitated by the fundamental change occurring in the East. It's not just that we are seeing surprising acceptances of the movement toward German unification, even with Gorbachev accepting it as a predictable result. It is that we've seen a shift in the attitude among senior Soviets about the future of NATO. They continue to talk about the elimination of foreign bases. They continue to talk about a change in the alliance structure. But for the intermediate period, which I think is the decade of the 1990s and perhaps heading into the next century, there are signs that the Soviets recognize that NATO is a key source of reassurance to them that the Americans will stay engaged in a moderating role within the European security context. They understand that a resurgent Germany is less likely if there is the balancing presence of the United States. The concern about that resurgence is obviously not unique to the Soviet Union. It's shared by Germany's other neighbors. And one other message of an affirmative character, I think, lies in the maturity of German statecraft at this historic juncture. The Germans understand their neighbor's anxiety. Despite the commotion that has occurred over the Chancellor's protracted dancing around the issue of Polish borders, Bonn explicitly recognizes that German unity can come only as part of a larger European process. No one can foresee exactly how the reassociation of Germans will develop. But the argument that NATO should serve as a kind of governor on German unification is untenable. The NATO presence is, in fact, to help embed the Germans in a mutually acceptable collective enterprise. And I think it is a tribute to German leadership at this stage that they recognize the necessity for these larger institutions and are not solely preoccupied with unification, even while they're caught up in the excitement of revived national identity. The political flux in which NATO dwells makes it impossible to project its future with confidence, but imprudent to ignore its continued importance. The alliance has passed many severe tests over the years. French withdrawal from the integrated military structure, the arrival of superpower strategic parity, and the implication for extended deterrence, fierce struggles over the deployment of theater nuclear weapons. Now comes a more demanding test. Can NATO safeguard European stability, purchased so dearly over the decades, by helping its members keep in phase the myriad tasks of constructing a new security order? I wanted to take a few moments before we turn to questions to look beyond these alliance-specific issues and mention a few of the questions that form an important backdrop for the resolution of the protracted security confrontation in Europe, namely the Soviet-American strategic dialogue involved in the strategic arms reduction talks and related matters. We and the Soviets have vital business to do with each other beyond the European theater. We're bound together in a relationship that, since neither can escape, both must manage. The emerging civility of Soviet-American discourse is prerequisite to that task. One of the basic questions is how far we can carry this arms reduction process, both in conventional forces and in strategic forces. To speak in shorthand, my own judgment is there's likely to be some disappointment when our people realize how modest a reduction actually results from the first strategic arms agreement, which we may see this summer. It will leave both the United States and the Soviet Union with more than 9,000 strategic warheads. This is a result of the unusual counting rules that are being negotiated, counting rules which I personally favor. They're a necessary part of the package deal, but which will permit the United States to retain thousands of additional bomber weapons not counted, gravity bombs and the like, short-range attack missiles, are not going to be counted as separate weapons. And similarly, both sides will be able to retain large numbers of sea-launched cruise missiles with nuclear capabilities. I think that the pressure will be on to move rapidly beyond the still high levels of strategic forces. And so the question is, how far can you go? There have been important analyses by Michael May and colleagues at the Livermore Laboratory, which conclude that strategic stability is safe, confident, at levels of about 3,000 warheads on each side. So my own instinct would be to say we can proceed with bargaining to an additional plateau, well below what we're likely to get in the first START agreement. Similarly, I would want to associate myself with General Goodpaster's judgment that in Europe, we can move on beyond the conventional force negotiation that is now being concluded and aim for levels at approximately 50% the scale of recent deployments on the two sides. That now becomes a kind of benchmark for the next negotiation. Whereas a year ago, when he made the proposal, it seemed a ludicrous, reckless, impossible notion. It is now in the range of serious discourse, and I would take it, if not as the first objective, as a reasonable end result. In all of this process, we're looking for a reinforcement of the trend toward mutual restraint and cooperative force adjustments. It does not seem to me wise for leaders to hold out the probably false hope of eliminating all nuclear weapons. No one has devised a plausible program for achieving that goal. In the face of the risks of cheating, clandestine proliferation, and the likely opposition of other states which already possess such weapons, abolition is less a workable ideal than a dangerous illusion. The realistic objective is to manage the condition of mutual vulnerability, which will persist through our lives and the lives of our children, as far ahead as we can see. It has profound hazards, and it has perverse benefits. But we will not serve our obligation well if we raise the unworkable notion of an early movement toward the abolition of all nuclear weapons. We don't know how to do that. Now, I'm going to cease and desist without going into some of the detailed issues that remain in the strategic negotiations. Let me capsule it in sort of bullet terms, a printer's bullet, not a soldier's bullet. A very important objective, which I think is now achievable, is to demerv the ballistic missile force deployed on land. That is, take the ballistic missiles down from the large number of multiple warheads now deployed to an emphasis on smaller single warhead systems, which are more stable, less inviting for attack, and more compatible with the reduced scale of deployments toward which we are working. Secondly, not only should demerving be a prime topic for the follow-on negotiations, we are breeding a problem we have not addressed satisfactorily in the sea-launched cruise missile field. There are several aspects of naval arms control which require attention in the next negotiations. Paul Nitze has raised an idea that many of us think will have to be looked at seriously, the prospect of denuclearizing, taking nuclear weapons off all surface ships and confining nuclear forces to submarine forces at sea, so far as the Navy is concerned. We can talk about the pros and cons of that in question period if you're interested. But one thing that in particular must be done, whether or not we denuclearize all surface vessels, we've got to get a better handle on the sea-launched cruise missile than we have presently planned in the first START agreement. It looks as though we will rely on simply a declaration of the scale of nuclear cruise missiles the two sides plan to deploy. That is not a satisfactory outcome from the standpoint of American security. The Soviets have, for many years, maintained a very large force of relatively short-range, relatively big warhead, sea-launched cruise missiles. It is not in our interest to allow that force to have a free ride, partly because we're going to see thousands of sea-launched cruise missiles, most of which are intended to have conventional warheads, but which represent a powerful breakout possibility. That is, they could produce large numbers of nuclear warheads beyond those being regulated in the nuclear agreement by converting from conventional to nuclear warheads. There are technologies for controlling that. I won't go into the details of it unless there's specific interest. A colleague and I have framed a technical approach which, knowing the Navy's fondness for acronyms, is second only to its fondness for boats, we call SAILOR, Secure Anti-Interference Locking Restraint. The concept is one that basically would be designed to prevent the conversion of a conventional cruise missile to a nuclear cruise missile. The technology involved is at hand, readily usable, would not interfere with the operational capability of the conventional cruise missile, which we need to retain in our force structure. We use the technology in our nuclear weapons today. We call them permissive action links. They are electronic locks. We use electronic locks to prevent the unauthorized detonation of a nuclear weapon. We can use the same technology, modified only in slight degree, to prevent the unauthorized conversion of a conventional warhead missile to a nuclear weapon. Whether we use that technology or some other, we're going to have to figure out a way to make sure that the thousands of cruise missiles do not become readily convertible to nuclear weapons as opposed to their initial conventional configurations. I think I'm going to stop there. I realize I've gone a bit longer than I intended to anyway. I want to do it with perhaps an invocation of my favorite theme, perhaps one that Ken has used. I may even have read it in something he wrote some time ago. Cardinal Newman once said that we cannot relive history, but we can repair it. What is underway after the great success of containment, the demonstration that a democracy and democratic allies can hold the line for decades if necessary, what is now underway is a massive repair job. A repair job that gives us, I think, a basis for more hope than any of us have been privileged to hold for most of our lives. More hope that we can build a civilized world order in which the threat of nuclear war is greatly diminished, the threat of conventional war is contained, and the energies we've invested in hostility can be directed toward worthwhile common objectives. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Who'd like to ask the first question? Al Fernbach, Professor Fernbach.
Your talk, I think, is very encouraging, and I'm delighted with many of the points that you made. I want to swing back to the first part of the talk, the NATO aspect, and the question of a new mission, and simply ask whether the major threat in the next 10 or 20 years may not, in fact, be ethnic and nationalistic historic revivals. And NATO, for all its bumps and ups and downs, has, as you say, created an atmosphere of huddling together successfully. Can it extend its huddling to begin to handle this threat?
It's a very good question, because we already see signs that you're raising an issue that has an unfortunate half-life ahead of us. I would like to think that it can at least provide us the benefit of the power of example. Whether or not we can see it as having a direct application to the ethnic unrest that is emerging primarily in the East. Obviously, you have in mind not only within the Soviet Union, but some of the other ethnic and border frictions between Romania and Hungary.
And revival of German nationalism.
All of that is on the agenda in a form that we haven't wrestled with for some time. I'm not confident that as an alliance, NATO can deal with that explicitly. I do not think NATO can deal with it by anticipating the actual use of force on a collective basis. But I think it can contribute an environment of restraint, mechanisms for political consultation in which the parties to those ethnic disputes and nationalistic revivals hear consistently and emphatically the messages of their neighbors that they share a collective concern about the resort to force. Within the Soviet Union, I think there is some chance that the mixed picture of ethnic unrest and early violence could actually induce a degree of sobriety that might take varied forms. I've looked over the last few days some of the publications of Literary Gazette, the Soviet journal, which is now being published in English. and to their own people, the Soviets have been distributing photographs of what happened in Baku and Tbilisi in the last year and a half. Photographs which have the flavor Americans would recognize as similar to the child burning after the napalm attack in Vietnam. They're images that register, you'll carry them to your grave. You cannot forget them. They're terrible. And I have the feeling that there is a net benefit for that aspect of Glasnost within the Soviet Union, displaying to their own people the outcome of violence. I don't know that it will be sufficient to stop the violence, but I think, among other things, it will certainly encourage the Armenians, for example, to recognize that they do need some protection from authority beyond their neighbors, and therefore they may look to a larger collective security, whether or not it is a Soviet central authority or something of a more European nature. It may encourage Soviet military professionals to hold to the line they've begun to voice over the last 2 years, that is not their job to intervene to suppress unrest, that it has to be done locally with minimum force, and that's not a proper military function. You'll hear that from General Yazov and Marshal Akhramayev. They do not wish to see the Soviet military redeployed inward for domestic suppression. Now, those are not factors which predict a wholesome outcome, and I've wandered off your question specifically about NATO, but they strike me as elements in a very complicated simultaneous equation in which many things are at work all at once. And I hope they will produce restraint on the part of most of the contentious forces. That is more a hope than a prediction. I think there could be significant unrest and some violence, but I don't think that we're going to see it become the pattern of the new Europe. I don't believe we're going to see extensive violence as the habit of the parties involved. I probably should just stop there because it is a zone of speculation that anyone here can, I'm sure, do better with than I can.
Other questions?
Yes.
Wilford Grantham and Bill.
Two questions. One, why are the Czechs playing such a, what to me, a good role in trying not to slap the Germans down after the treatment they got just before World War II, and also that they dished out to the Sudeten people? They still seem to be, or is it just Havel's leadership that is doing that? And the second question, which is closely related, I saw an editorial recently in the New York Times saying that the problem that has not been attacked is this enormous political vacuum, that the disintegration of the Warsaw Pact will leave in Central Europe. And I understand that.
Well, ambitions ambitions revive in many forms. I think the Hungarians, along with the Poles and the Germans, are animated in part by tremendous debt problems. Their hard currency debt is very substantial, and they recognize the need to accelerate their connections to the hard currency markets, both financial markets and manufacturing trade markets. So I think it is not surprising that there would be a powerful impulse from Hungary to link up quickly with Austria more closely. By the way, the Germans are extremely appreciative of the Hungarian role in breaking the ice in the whole east-west situation. You'll hear constantly in Bonn great expressions of gratitude for the way the Hungarians allowed the East Germans to move through Hungary out of the country. There's just the sense that that was a critical moment, as I think we all recognize. I think it's not surprising that there would be a desire to link up Budapest with other trading and financial partners, primarily for economic reasons. I am very skeptical, though perhaps I should not be, very skeptical that anything resembling the revival of a fragmentary Austro-Hungarian imperial connection would take place, partly because that would leave those capitals somewhat on the sidelines to the main game. The main game is the European community writ large. and the European community is the objective that many in the East have as their primary goal, to tie in more directly with what happens in Europe after 1992 economic integration. As far as the Czech role is concerned, I would relate that to the point I made. Yes.
What I would have expected of all this, after what happened, that the Czechs would feel just as bitter about the Germans as the Poles.
Part of it is certainly the elevated intellectual leadership and historic perspective that Havel has brought to office. But I think it's more than that. I think that there are lessons that have been learned by many Europeans. I have to believe that the tensions of the Cold War have shored up the awareness that hostility is not a fruitful enterprise for nations, that prejudice and vicious action toward a neighbor does not breed domestic benefit. So I read what is happening in Czechoslovakia, and indeed what is happening throughout the region, as comparable to what I've described as the maturity of German statecraft. The Germans are a powerful nation. They're going to get more powerful, but they are, I think, quite clear-headed in understanding that the power of a nation in the 21st century to serve its people is not the power of the Reich. It's not the power of Imperial Germany. It is not primarily military power. It is primarily the force of advance that draws strength from economic development. And I think for that reason, while the old grudges may still be there, deeply embedded in the psyches of every one of the nations, there is a maturity in Europe that gives you pretty good hope that we can sort this process out. The most troublesome case probably is the Polish case, where we have a clear expression of concern centered on apprehension about what the Germans might do from Mazowiecki and the other leaders in Poland. They are going to be satisfied as these negotiations move forward. I feel quite certain they're going to be satisfied because the structure that has come into being, the so-called 2+4 talks, the two German states and the four allies which retain occupation rights in Berlin and in the countries, they're going to find a way to reassure the Poles that the outcome takes account of their concerns. I think the Germans themselves will not long linger in the ambivalent posture that seemed to mark some of Chancellor Kohl's statements. He himself has moved forward. There have been expressions that the two parliaments have made to reinforce the earlier treaty expressions by the German Democratic Republic and the Federal Republic respecting the sanctity of borders. One reason for that confidence, both about Poland and other cases, is that if we see a dilution of the alliance structure, we are simultaneously seeing a demand in Germany and elsewhere for the construction of a larger security order built on the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. Now, the CSCE process, which involves 35 nations, as you know, is not a block-to-block negotiation. It indeed is also not a structure that presently exists with any enforcement capabilities. But it is a legal order already in place in an early stage, which commits all of its parties to recognize the sanctity of the borders that exist at present. No change in the borders is likely to occur to the extent that the CSCE process comes to the fore. And I would confess, I have mixed feelings about the CSCE coming to the fore. It, in fact, would be a structure that weakens the role for NATO that I have advocated. If CSCE, with 35 participants, takes on the role of trying to verify the security arrangements, then I think that's a recipe for a weaker outcome and a serious weakening of the American role in NATO as a guardian. So I'm not entirely happy with the CSCE development that is being emphasized by some Europeans, but I mention it because it is the prime alternative. The present alternative guarantees the Polish borders because there are, although the Warsaw Pact is dissolving militarily, it is still in some sense a political reality. Interestingly, a political reality in which the Czechs, the Hungarians, and the Poles all split from the Soviets within the past few weeks to urge a continued American vital role in NATO and, more interestingly, a continued role for Germany in NATO. dissolving. So we are still seeing some important functions within the alliance structures. If it dissolves, then, as I say, the CSCE process is the preferred alternative by Europeans, and that, again, would fortify the political assurances for the border, not militarily, but politically.
Bill Wimple.
Just reading the papers since Friday suggests to me the gloomy idea that it's consistent with the word having gone out to Gorbachev from somewhere in the Kremlin, that under no circumstances is Lithuania or any other border state to be allowed to secede, to leave. You will just have to do whatever you have to do to make certain that doesn't happen. Now, if that's right, if there's any basis for that thought, and it's such a extraordinary change in what's been an extraordinary time of change, but in reverse, then that would suggest that many of the things going on in loosening up and in arms negotiations and everything may be due for getting not just shut off, but very sticky, very much slowed down, much less of what we've all been cheering about and thinking was happening.
We are all properly concerned about the Baltics, and specifically about what's happening in Lithuania. It's much too fluid a process to make any definitive comment about, but let me mention what I think are useful perspectives. Is it more surprising that there would be some assertion of continued Soviet authority in Lithuania by Gorbachev and the central government? Or is it more surprising and significant that that assertion is occurring in the context of new legislation moving forward in the Soviet Union, prescribing a specific path to permit secession? I think that you have to be very impressed, not only that violence has been avoided so far, I think the Lithuanians are quite clearly going to do everything they can not to instigate violence. There's no advantage to them. They're very adamant about asserting their independence, but recognizing that they are not in a position to win that independence by use of force. So there's not likely to be an instigation of violence from the Lithuanian side. And in those circumstances, I think the deployment of Soviet forces to occupy certain factories and maintain Soviet authority in the Republic can take place without extensive bloodshed. That is taking place in the context of the Soviet offer, perhaps as a bargaining base, of secession over a five-year period, subject to a referendum, and subject to a bargaining over what economic reparations or adjustments would be appropriate. Trying to be as even-handed as I can, I am inclined to think that we've seen here a not unreasonable display by Soviet authority that is less important than the offer to permit secession under an orderly process. So my inclination is to say we'll still be able to work through this process, not without some difficulties, some sticky moments, as you put it. But I do believe that they're not. There's no one in a position to coerce Gorbachev to abandon his commitment to allow secession under certain circumstances. And if there are any circumstances which would warrant secession from any part of the Soviet Union, those are the circumstances of 1940 and 41, the oppression of the Baltics. There is no part of the Soviet Union that has a clearer claim to exercise the right of secession than Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. So if I were betting a nickel, I would say it will be a difficult process. It won't happen as quickly as the Lithuanians wish. But during the 1990s, the Lithuanians will be an independent state.
Hope so.
Other questions? Howard Cromwell?
I wanted to know what your assessment is of the western part of Poland, it used to be Germany. If changing Poland to a democracy results in widespread unemployment, as there are some hints that it's going to. Is that part of Poland heavily dominated by German people, that they might want to be a part of Germany against the will of Poland, that would create an internal problem? And could it be offset if Poland was actually brought into the European community economically?
You touch a very nervous zone there, and I don't feel competent to give you a directly knowledgeable assessment. I've been in Poland very little. I don't have a personal reading on the ground. What I would base an estimate on is the firmness with which the Germans have made clear they are not going to be pressing for the return of those lands. There may be some understandable local desires by those of German ancestry living in Poland, a much smaller number than once was true. There may be some understandable desire to press for accession or connection or linkage to the new United Germany and to the European community. And your point that somehow that might diminish if Poland as a whole came into the European community has logic, has persuasive power. I think that as a probability, it's very low. I think Poland is in a very brave phase, high risk, high jolt economic shock is being administered. Surprisingly, with the Prime Minister retaining popularity on current surveys comparable to George Bush's 80%, which is a suggestion that leaders can take difficult measures and not sacrifice, at least in the short term, political popularity. But I think that they have such difficult economic straits that the prospect of early connection to the community, it's a very difficult prospect to assess. I think the prospects are low. We're talking about a country which has almost as much external hard currency debt as the much larger Soviet economy. The Soviet economy is the most under-leveraged economy in the world. They have very little external debt. That's why some of the bleak prognoses about the Soviet economic opportunities may be off the mark. But in the Polish case, it's overwhelming, it's staggering. They've got to get debt relief, or they're not going to have the resources to take advantage of this big change. That's why the European Eastern European Development Bank that's coming into view, led partly by the French, probably with a significant American participation, less than some would want, but significant, coupled with individual bilateral national contributions, including American contributions. They are extremely important, extremely urgent. They've got to get there early to get the Poles over this steep hump that they're trying to climb.
Just a moment. I happened to see somewhere in the last 2 weeks that in this, what is it, you're talking about Silesia, with Poland?
Yes.
And that they, for the first time in 40 years, the Germans in the Polish Silesia had been allowed to hold their services in German, which struck me as a nice thing.
That's a very important point. Now, some would say that revival of language rights and ethnic awareness could serve to reinforce ethnic separatism. That's not the intention of the Poles, obviously. They are trying to pacify a serious ethnic community of concern to them by being generous with regard to human rights of that nature. That is what you hope when democracy takes hold, that you will get just treatment, which reduces the separatist impulse.
Jack Armitage.
Oh, I'm just wondering, in this next round of negotiation, if we're throwing our net quite wide enough, you know, the pace of the events, none of us have ever seen anything in our lifetimes that have moved as rapidly and as frequently, unexpectedly as. Three things I wanted to raise a question about. One, I have a feeling that this half of the 195 is not ambitious enough for the next crack. First, in part, because it seems to me that the pressures on the Soviets for withdrawing all their troops from East Germany and Poland are going to be extreme indeed, and it's something that we should use instead of sort of slow down. But more importantly, it seems to me that in regard to shorter-range nuclear weapons, and I'm not quite sure what shorter range, whether I'm talking about 600 miles or 300 or few and conventional forces, that it ought to be a negotiation, because we're talking now about what the Germans are going to end up with, as well as what Ireland is going to be reduced to, and what the Soviets are going to end up with. It seems to me that the area ought to extend, in a sense, from the Atlantic to the Urals, that the European Soviet Union and the disposition of the forces there had better be part of this next negotiation. Second aspect that occurs to me is that nobody seems to be addressing this problem of the status of Eastern European countries. I mean, everybody knows what the East Europe as a staging ground has meant to us in terms of the threat from that area. But it seems to me that if I'm sitting in Moscow and thinking about my own security and what I'm going to be negotiating about, I want to obviate any chance that glacis is going to be used against me. And nobody seems to be addressing this thing and this business about neutral status for the Eastern European countries. And strangely enough, with all the talk about the Eastern Europe, you're already getting some murmurings of a possibility of maybe that they can be associated with NATO. Now if everything was fine and dandy, that'd be great, but I mean, that's not something the Soviets are going to buy, and if we want to get our continued presence in NATO assured, which sure as hell we do, I think we'd better start facing that issue. Nobody seems to be talking about it. Third and last, I'm sorry if it's long, but it seems to me that in our anxiety, and quite properly, to not let Cole off the hook on the border problem, that we may need something more than yes, there are going to be democracies as assurance for treatment of the ethnic minorities in Eastern Europe. And isn't it a fairly useful place to start to get with the border assurances something from the Poles particularly, and probably more easily from the Czechs, on what the rights of these people are? I think we're probably overly worried about the resurgence of some kind of strong nationalism. We had the pleasure of talking to Bert von Staden a couple of weeks ago, and when we got to talking about these Germans, they are not this business about their there's a sort of some level of concern about language in schools and all that, but most of these Germans that have come back from that area to West Germany can't even speak decent German, so we don't want to exaggerate that, but their rights, it seems to me, is to take some action fairly soon on them would help to defuse this as a future problem. You can argue it both ways, as you said, but I'd be on the side of, because the Poles are not easy people to deal with. They're heroic, they're lovable, they're just like the French, you know, individually they're great and their politics stink, you know, from a long time back. Those three elements, it seems to me, it ought to be in there somewhere for our, as we come into this next big round after we get the 195 nailed down.
Jack, I welcome that. Those are all very important points and worth a brief comment. Let me walk backwards through it. I think we have, in the Helsinki process, of course, the security preoccupations, but we have equally important working approaches to ensuring human rights within the wider European community, involving demands for open reporting, human rights visiting teams, and things of that sort, which are directed at this concern of whether not just the Soviets, but others might continue to oppress minorities. The Romanians, particularly. The Romanians have been a pretty bad case and have been the object of vivid critique within the European communities, the CSCE community.
Did you get TV this morning, by the way?
No, I'm not.
It looks like that in response to this, quite unexpectedly that this democratic, I forgot what the name, forum, this crowd that is the ultra-nationalist Hungarians, probably are going to come out with the biggest vote in the Hungarian elections.
I did see that headline, and I think a lot of people are surprised at how much of a surge has occurred there. Although there is such a splintering, I don't know what the numbers are, but I feel sure that that outcome will have many parties involved, so that only a plurality is likely to go with that particular faction. And we're going to see in all of these countries a period in which we and they themselves are learning their actual political demography. We don't know the distribution of preference and value and political influence because it's not been tested for half a century. So in Germany, East Germany, I think we've already seen that with the important elections earlier, and it's going to be a shakedown period where even the early results are not a good guide to what will actually emerge as bargaining takes place and coalitions are formed.
The rapidity of the collapse of this different socialist way in East Germany as a political idea is remarkable.
It is. And
all of a sudden it was the cradle of a party, and whack, it's not doing it.
Exactly so. The theme I would strike is we've got to be very careful to make sure this is a period of reorientation rather than disorientation, because we're all just disoriented by what all is happening. One point I would want to make, though, is on the human rights front particularly, there is already planned a major human rights conference in Moscow, bringing 35 nations to Moscow to subject their developments to scrutiny, to compare notes on similar human rights practices and problems throughout Europe, not just Eastern Europe. But I think we're going now to see, in all probability, in most cases, perhaps not Romania, in most cases, the final flowering of the Charter 77 kind of self-examination that developed abortively for a time in Czechoslovakia, but gave us Václav Havel eventually. We're going to see those self-evaluation processes on human rights take hold in each of those countries and contribute to both measuring what's going on and perhaps making sure that the process respects minority rights. Your earlier suggestion is one that I think is worth agreement with. I'm not sure I can do more than say what you've said, that the notion that we should cut another 50% out of 195,000 American and Soviet troops is only a part of what the next stage of conventional force negotiations must be. A special difficulty that will have to be addressed out of respect for the collective concern in Europe is the scale of the German military force. We could see, if there were an amalgamation of the military capabilities, a German presence on the order of 600,000 men under arms in the course of the 1990s. As the other forces are drawn down, that would give pause to many nations in Europe. The Germans know that. They are, I think, on the way, in the course of the many changes they have to make, to thinking through a substantial adjustment in their own military capability to be defined in the collective negotiation. I think they are right to say that we must adjust the scale. We must not leave anyone in suspicion that the German military weight is going to rise as others reduce. So they're prepared to adjust the scale, in my opinion. That's even more true, of course, were there to be a change of government in a united Germany, were there to be a social democratic government. They are professing a desire to keep NATO intact and the American presence alive on a diminished scale, but they would still foresee a much more substantial reduction in the German defense investment. And of course, just think it through with the not just tens of billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars in required investment to move the East German economy up to a competitive scale comparable to that in the West. The Germans have large incentives to trade off their defense budget, to take their peace dividend in a more direct way than we are trying to take ours. So I think there are real dynamics at work which contemplate, as you were implying, reductions beyond even the scale that I mentioned earlier.
And I have a hunch that we ought to be crowding the Soviets in a number of ways, because strangely enough, not too many people have noticed that with all of Gorbachev's domestic problems, all the troubles he's in and things he has to overcome, he has not really been seriously attacked on his whole international posture.
That's right.
I don't mean that everybody agrees with him.
No.
Far out of touch, but...
It is a political asset for him. You know, he's able to win plaudits abroad.
He's got to have big reductions if he's going to have any hope that he's going to do something radical on the Indian economy.
That is certainly true. Now, there are two points I would inject. Not every point I make heads in the same direction. I'm just, in a sense, reporting aspects rather than saying this is a linear and connected argument. I believe that the context we're moving through could well warrant, as Foreign Minister Genscher has indicated, a significant Soviet military presence on German territory, even after unification. What do I mean by significant? I mean a few tens of thousands, primarily for the verification and implementation functions, rather than the hundreds of thousands that have been there. So I myself would not today say that the early objective should be zero Soviet military presence in that area, partly because they need reassurance in order to buy the other parts of the package that we're trying to sell, which would move them very heavily out of Eastern Europe. Secondly, the reductions are indeed going to have to take place all the way to the Urals. The early evidence is before we get a negotiated result, we are going to see reductions in the Atlantic to the Urals arena. In key areas. The Soviets have drawn down about 2,700 tanks out of the 5,000 that Gorbachev promised to remove unilaterally before there's even an agreement. They have taken out more than a quarter of a million men out of the armed forces in Eastern Europe. And those are the large early installments on what will be a net reduction of 500,000 men in the Atlantic to the Urals, including Western Soviet military districts. And 5,000 tanks. Interestingly, the Soviets are also in the conventional force negotiations accepting our demand that not only tanks be reduced, but that they take out the bridging equipment. They have on the order of 2,200 so-called armor-launched bridges, and they, in fact, are prepared to come down to 700, which is roughly the number in which that's the number we put forward. It's a few more than we have, but it's the number we put forward as the objective. And that, again, means that their posture has to be more defensive because they can't advance. As you know, Director Webster has already testified publicly to the growing confidence in our intelligence community that were there to be no further adjustments, we already have a major increase in warning time. The Soviets would have to do many, many things, even if there were no negotiated reductions beyond today's unilateral measures.
Even Pearl has said so.
Yes, even Pearl has said so. Now, there is and one other element in this, that's part of the good news. I don't know if what I have to say next is good news or bad news. It's just mixed news. Out of the concern over German unification, the Poles, of course, have made clear that they would prefer to see a continued Soviet military presence on Polish territory. Life is filled with ironies, but you now have the Poles making clear that until they see the dust settle on the political process to their west, they want to keep the 40,000 Soviet troops, or some significant number, on Polish territory. My impression has always been, frankly, that the Soviets in Poland have kept to themselves so much that the disruption in the local populace has been minor. They're not very visible.
Even in 1980,
that's a very important point. So it's not entirely surprising that Poles don't feel as heavy a burden. They do not have quite the history that Czechoslovakia and Hungary, or even East Germany, had with regard to Soviet military pressure. But it is still an interesting and surprising development that some of the Warsaw Pact new leadership, Mazowiecki himself, would be saying, it isn't entirely bad that there are some Soviets in Eastern Europe.
Tom, can you ask your question after
very
this?
Very quick.
All right, very quick.
Does the 195,000 ceiling that we're hearing about include theater, air, and naval forces?
Yes.
Or is it just ground troops?
No, that, I think, is the total complement. I haven't looked back at the formulation, but that's the total.
Of course, in the Navy, you make up quite a chunk. You take something like the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean and the Air Force and the elements in England and so on. That's all.
But that is one reason why Secretary Baker insisted on the asymmetry and the allowance for 30,000 above the 195 to permit us to keep a sufficient fleet base at Naples and elsewhere. There is a number. I don't know what it is myself, but I know there is a number. Uh, all, already concluded by the most senior American military leadership, below which they would decide retaining ground forces is not militarily sensible. I don't know what the number is, but there is a kind of drop-off ledge where, to put it as one of them put it the other day, he is not comfortable going down to a level at which he basically says to his young man in the field that he's there as a hostage. I mean, there has to be a fighting capability for our Army leadership to say they will retain ground forces. It's a little different for our Navy and Air Force because their role can remain a support role in conjunction with Allied ground personnel. But as far as the Army is concerned, I do think that we would, at some point, I don't know if it's at the 100K range or not, but somewhere down in there, I think the American military recommendation would be to go to zero on the ground complement.
Every time I read in the newspapers about the Council on Foreign Relations, I don't recognize it, especially certain newspapers. And today, those of us who've heard Alton Frye probably have a better conception of the quality of people who participate in these discussions at the Council. But having said that, he stands above all of them and has certainly given leadership in a much wider sector than simply his own organization. And we're sorry we had a dialogue going on outside, but Jack Armitage brought that to a close. And next time we hope when Alton comes, we hope the outside world would be as quiet as all of you were as you listened with such appreciation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.